Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. So Alberto Gonzalez is out, but Congress is back, and so are the questions about the executive privilege that the Bush White House has asserted with such extraordinary determination. At the heart of that asserted privilege and power is secrecy. Secrecy about wiretapping, about torture, about politics and the Justice Department, about the Vice President's office, about maybe millions of missing White House emails. What do Congress and the American people have a right to know? Hearings are coming back. Subpoenas are ready to fly. Up next, On Point, the battle lines over presidential power and secrecy in Washington. Joining us first today from Washington is Rebecca Carr, national correspondent for Cox Newspapers, including the Atlanta Journal-Constitution and Austin American Statesman. For 3 years, she's been focusing on issues of secrecy and open government in the executive branch. Her blog for Cox Newspapers is called The Secrecy File. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here, I'm looking at a piece from you just in the last day or two on a new report, yet another from, an independent group criticizing the Bush administration for its degree of secrecy. Who's saying what?
Well, that's right. The group is called OpenTheGovernment.org, and it's a coalition of groups, conservative groups as well as liberal groups that are concerned about the growing rate of government secrecy. And their report that just came out Saturday found out that the government secrecy is expanding at an unprecedented clip. And this is happening against a backdrop of growing public concern about barriers being erected to information that is information for the public, and as well as growing concern about civil liberty violations. Last year, for example, they found out that the government taxpayers spent $8.2 billion, a 7.5% increase over the year before, to conceal government documents.
Just to stamp them with the, secrecy stamp?
Yes, that's right. They have several different categories of information for classifying material. They call it top secret, secret. In addition, that's just the information that's monitored by the government. There's also a host of categories called pseudo-classification, where government bureaucrats dump information. This is information that goes off the public websites, off the public libraries, into these so-called pseudo-classification categories, and it's information that just merely disappears. It goes into a black box.
This particular coalition's director, Patrice McDermott, says the current administration has increasingly refused to be held accountable to the public. A Democratic-led Congress has been determined for some months now to try and get behind some of that. Some say it's politics. Some say we've got a constitutional crisis. What's the lineup as Congress comes back into session? What array of hearings are we looking at, and how does secrecy lie behind them, Rebecca?
Well, just to stop you there for 1 second, though, the administration has a response to that. They say, well, we are in a time of heightened security due to the war in Iraq,
right,
due to the conflict in Afghanistan, as well as, you know, this stateless terrorism that we're fighting. So they say some of the secrecy is warranted, and if you look back into history, you'll see that during the Roosevelt administration, when we were fighting World War II, there was also an increase in secrecy. But the secrecy index that's measured by the OpenTheGovernment.org finds that this is unparalleled and unprecedented, and that you see secrecy growing at a clip that is historically unparalleled. And so when Congress comes back today, you are going to see a feisty Democratic-led Congress looking into several areas where they hope to uncover some of the partisan reasons for secrecy.
Give us a quick rundown of what to expect there.
Sure, absolutely. Well, perhaps the most intriguing is the U.S. Attorney probe. Both the House and the Senate Judiciary Committees are investigating whether 9 U.S. attorneys were fired for partisan political gain. At issue here is whether they were fired for failing to hasten indictments against Democrats, and whether they were failing to hasten indictments against Democratic-leaning voter rights groups just before last fall's election that put the Democrats back in control of Congress. And they're also looking at whether some of the top prosecutors were fired for aggressively pursuing Republicans, such as Randy Duke Cunningham, the now-imprisoned former congressman from California. And at issue in that investigation is, what was the White House's involvement, particularly Karl Rove's involvement, in orchestrating the dismissal of these attorneys? At one point, they wanted to get rid of all 93 U.S. attorneys across the country. And that, you might say, well, you know, these guys, you know, serve at the pleasure of the president. Well, that's not so true. They serve at the pleasure of the president, but they've never in the history of the Justice Department been replaced wholesale midterm. That's what's new here.
We've also got issues around how torture or extreme interrogation got approved, around warrantless wiretapping.
Those all surround Alberto Gonzalez. So last week we saw Alberto Gonzalez stepping down. I'm here to tell you that the investigations into Alberto Gonzalez are just gearing up. We're going to see just tomorrow, we have the House Judiciary Committee holding a hearing on FISA violations. Those are violations looking at the warrantless surveillance tactics by the Bush administration. Two years ago, we learned that President Bush's secret surveillance program in America, domestic surveillance in America, was going on, and Congress is still trying to get to the bottom of why did the administration feel compelled to circumvent the law. There's a law called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act that was passed by Congress in 1978 and has been routinely updated throughout the history of the law. And what we find is that the administration has still not produced to Congress the legal justification for circumventing that law.
Are committee chairmen expecting Alberto Gonzalez to show up and sit before them now that he's resigned?
Absolutely.
I mean, are they realistically anticipating that, or is he likely to say, no, I'm going to cut brush in Texas?
He can't, because he is still under the committees can still subpoena him to come before Congress.
What about subpoenas? There's been talk about all kinds of subpoenas potentially flying. What's out there already, and what may be coming that would push us closer to a real legal showdown here?
Well, we do have a real legal showdown occurring right now. I mean, Congress is expected, and I spoke with John Conyers, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, just last week about this, and he said, in no way will his investigation fizzle. He is planning to pursue contempt proceedings against former White House counsel Harriet Myers, as well as other White House officials who refused to come forward and produce evidence as well as testimony. So here we are, you know, 2 years after we found out about the secret surveillance program in America. That's the warrantless surveillance program, and you better believe they're going to be holding these former White House officials accountable as well as current White House officials.
And if they don't show, Karl Rove, Harriet Myers, Gonzalez, what happens?
Well, the next step is to seek contempt proceedings, have Congress pass a contempt citation against them, and then to take it to the federal court. But I believe that the White House, you know, we've seen some signs over the August recess that the White House and the Senate Judiciary Chairman Patrick Leahy are going to work out some form of compromise for some testimony to come forward without going to the length of a contempt citation. For example, Chairman Leahy held a press conference earlier in August where we were given the impression that, you know, that they were working out an agreement for the testimony to come forward. And so I think that you will see White House officials, current and former White House officials, come forward, and maybe it won't be in the public limelight, maybe it'll be behind closed doors. But as Arlen Specter, the ranking member of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has said, let's just get to the bottom of it. Let's, you know, forget the big show trial. Let's just find an answer to what happened here, both in the U.S. attorney scandal as well as the scandal into the legal justification for violating the law. And of course the Bush administration says we didn't violate the law, we asserted our executive privilege.
But you've got to kind of see the record to know what's actually going on. We'll see what comes to the light of day. Rebecca Carr, national correspondent for Cox Newspapers, thanks very much for being with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
In a few minutes, we'll hear opposing views on the big constitutional questions here. But first, joining us from Cleveland, Ohio, is Ted Gupp, former investigative reporter for The Washington Post and Time Magazine, now a professor of journalism at Case Western Reserve University. His new book is Nation of Secrets, The Threat to Democracy and the American Way of Life. Ted Gupp, thanks very much for being here.
Hello, Tom.
How does secrecy figure into this big battle over powers, executive versus legislative, that's going on right now?
Well, I think you've answered the question. It should not be viewed in isolation. It's part of a broader pattern. The best way to disarm and neutralize the opposition is to withhold information. And I think it really should be seen less as an issue of national security than as a power play. And I think many of these events that you're witnessing now date back not so much to 9/11 as they do to more than 30 years ago, to the big hearings over the CIA in the mid-70s, to Watergate and the post-Watergate reforms, when people like Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld believed that the presidency was to some degree eviscerated, and they have been determined ever since to reestablish a more potent Oval Office.
Is that a credible argument? Do you see a legitimate rebalancing going on here, or something that's without precedent?
Well, I'm not sure it's an all or nothing, but I do believe that at this point now, the veil of secrecy has descended with such a thud that it really does threaten the notion of a tripartite form of government, that the Congress has been largely marginalized and peripheralized to some degree by its own ineptitude, but I do think that the whole process now of oversight, investigation, et cetera, has been imperiled. When Rebecca Carr was talking about some kind of compromise that Leahy was pursuing, mm-hmm. Maybe you'd have White House officials testifying behind closed doors. Well, behind closed doors is precisely what secrecy is about.
We're talking this hour about Congress and the White House girding for another round of hearings over secrets and executive privilege. All the way back in March of 2002, President Bush was asked if he was trying, through the handling of information, to recalibrate the power balance between Congress and the presidency.
We'll let all the kind of the legal historians figure out all that out, you know. First of all, I'm not going to let Congress erode the power of the executive branch. I have a duty to protect the executive branch from legislative encroachment. I mean, for example, when the GAO demands documents from us, we're not going to give them to them. I mean, it's just, these were privileged conversations. These were conversations when people come into our offices and brief us. And can you imagine having to give up every single transcript of what is advised me or the vice president? Our advice wouldn't be good and honest and open.
President Bush, 2002, just last month, August 2nd, Senator Patrick Leahy, chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, held another hearing on the U.S. attorney firings. He cross-examined White House political affairs aide Scott Jennings about an email sent to Karl Rove through a Republican National Committee account. Though Leahy had the email in his hand, the president had asserted executive privilege over it.
Was the information you received in this email on February 28th of this year new to you?
Senator, I'm going to have to decline to answer that question pursuant to the president's assertion.
It's interesting. Even if we do get documents, we're told you can't talk about the documents. This is... Do you ever read Catch-22 when you were younger?
I'm familiar with the phrase.
You read the book?
I did not. I have not.
You might want to go back and read it. It's very interesting. It seems to be part of your training manual.
Senator Patrick Leahy and the Justice Department's Scott Jennings on August 2nd. We've been joined from Cleveland, Ohio by Ted Gupp, former investigative reporter for The Washington Post and Time Magazine, author of the new book, Nation of Secrets. I'm joined right now in the studio as well by David Barron, professor at Harvard Law School. He's paid a lot of attention to what goes on with the balance of power issues in our government. David Barron, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So, do you see a constitutional crisis in all this wrangling over information and secrecy?
There's certainly a constitutional fight of very serious proportions going on, and I think Ted Gupp's point about putting it in context, I think, is exactly right. And another context to think about the claim to secrecy is the following. The administration's made two additional very controversial and aggressive constitutional arguments. one of which has to do with their claim about controlling the bureaucracy as a whole, which is a kind of unitary executive point.
Big phrase, important phrase
and
in,
the,
in their
the importance
work.
Of it is their idea that the people serving in the administration are really entirely under their control and to be directed as they want. That attitude runs the risk that experts within the government, people that are taking those jobs and confirmed by the Senate, not just to serve the president's partisan interests, but to serve the nation as a whole, would become tools of a partisan agenda. And you see that coming out in the course of the U.S. attorney's fight. The second big argument they've made is that you can't tell us what to do when it comes to war making. And that you see coming out in the context of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act controversy and the Torture Act controversy, which is essentially that statutes restricting what the president can do in the way he wants to prosecute the war on terrorism simply are null and void and can be disregarded by him. When you see those two constitutional claims being made by the president, you can see why the secrecy argument becomes particularly potent. Because if you want to evaluate whether or not the president's a lawbreaker or whether or not the president's impermissibly using the bureaucracy for partisan ends, it becomes quite important to see, well, what are you actually doing? And it's at that moment that the relatively traditional claim of executive privilege made by presidents going back in time is now asserted, but it's in this context where I think you have real concerns being raised about the legitimacy of the claim.
Ted Gupp, give us a sense then of how this claim is playing out. We've heard some examples here, but give us a sense of the scale. I mean, we've got the Freedom of Information Act, which is supposed to be a kind of a daylight guarantee for a lot of information. What has happened in the years of the Bush administration as they have looked to assert the unitary executive and these presidential war powers?
Well, just as the war on terror is a war on multi-fronts, so is the war on information. I mean, one of the first things that the administration did under Attorney General John Ashcroft was to reverse the polarities of the Freedom of Information Act, which is the crown jewel of access. He basically sent out a memo to all the agencies and departments in government and said, if you can find a reason to deny a request, if it passes the straight-face test, we'll back you up. That green-lighted refusals and denials government-wide. So that was one major change. Another attack on information was the explosion of materials that were not classified but were not accessible, so-called sensitive but unclassified materials. There are literally millions of people in government and industry who now possess the authority, perhaps not the right, but the authority to stamp something sensitive but unclassified, internal use only, official use only. What's happened in a democracy, it's not so much what the product of the decision is as it is the ability to ascertain the integrity of the decision-making process. If you cannot reconstruct those pathways of decision-making, you're stymied in a democracy. That's what we have now. We can see what the administration decides. What we can't see is how it got there, and that is enveloped in secrecy, in sensitive but unclassified, and a whole host of other efforts to obfuscate and block scrutiny.
David Barron, then what is at stake as Congress digs on in here in hearings? Precedents are, I guess, either being set or undone. So, you know, if things stand as they are, what does that mean about the presidential power going forward, secrecy, executive privilege? If they're reversed, you know, what's kind of in the balance here?
Well, I think there's two different contexts in which the precedents are being made. One is in the courts, and there's state secrets arguments being made in the context of suits now ongoing in various lower courts regarding attempts to get access to what the actual program is of warrantless surveillance that's occurring. If those state secrets claims hold, that will be governing law, and it will mean that attempts in the future to sue or challenge or get access to all kinds of surveillance activities that the federal government engages in, it'll be available to executive branches to say you simply can't get it, and courts would presumably enforce the government's position. But the second context...
Hold on with that one for a second. Will that be a new nation described by that precedent? Or will that be outside the realm of what we've been since the Constitution was drafted, or within?
I'd put it this way. There's always been secrets claims floating around. This is, as is often the case with the Bush administration, the most aggressive reading and use of those precedents. And so were they now applied by the courts and the government were to win, I think it's fair to say you'd have the most expansive notion of state secrets being adopted that we've had in the history of the country.
And the second front?
The second front, I think, is a more hard to pin down sort of precedent, and it simply practices norms and customs between the branches. So the way executive privilege is normally played out in our history is through a principle not written down in law particularly, known as accommodation, which is the two branches essentially work it out. It's a political fight to some extent, but it's also a structural fight, and it's a fight about the nature of the democracy. Both parties give and take a little bit, and eventually some compromise is reached. The really dramatic thing that's occurring now is the breaking point is being reached on each side. Contempt citations may come down. The government's already said that those will not be enforced by any prosecutor. And something will either happen or not happen at that point. One is the old notion of accommodation will come back into play, and some way of each side saving face will be reached, and we'll step back from the brink. The other possibility is it gets pushed to court, and we finally get a Supreme Court ruling on executive privilege in this context. I think that's unlikely to occur because I think it's going to be very hard to get it into court.
The court would not want to rule on it.
A, I think they may not want to rule on it, and B, I'm not sure either the president or the Senate will want the court to rule on it because they don't know which way they'll go. And
it would be massively consequential either way.
Either way. And then the last possibility is that what we might have is a kind of standoff in which the contempt citation lies there. The president simply says, I'm not going to enforce it. And then it's hard to know what we make of that as a precedent, right? What it
would
show.
Kind of netherworld that we
netherworld, but it would show on the one hand that a president who plays extreme hardball may be able to push the system in a way in which he is immune from real scrutiny. But it also might be that the consequence of playing hardball that way is to so enrage the public or to seem so extreme that the next president will come into office committed to a principle of openness. And we've seen historically that happen. Recall that after the Nixon administration, what we got was the Carter administration. The Carter administration took a notably different attitude towards the legitimacy of the legislature regulating the presidency, and that was precisely because of the public's reaction to these extreme claims.
David Barron, Ted Gupp, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from Washington, Viet Dinh, former Assistant Attorney General under George W. Bush from 2001 to 2003. He's now a professor of Georgetown at Georgetown University Law Center. He was Chief Legal Architect of the USA Patriot Act. Viet Dinh, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Tom. Hi, David. Hi, Ted.
Hello.
Hello to all. You were kind of there at the creation, in a sense. Do you think the administration, since your involvement with drafting the Patriot Act, has gone too far in asserting executive privilege, Viet Dinh?
Several observations. I think David's points previously made were very good points, very well made. I would like to point out the fact that most of the activities relating to the war on terror have happened with the concurrence of the legislative branch. I think the USA Patriot Act stands as the paradigm of executive legislative cooperation in seeking new authorities or expanded authorities in a way that is democratically accountable and reviewable.
Though there were assertions at that time that Congress scarcely had enough access to know what was really in the Patriot Act.
Well, I mean, I've heard that. I think most famously made in Fahrenheit 9/11. I think that's specious at best. The notion that the legislators do not read the acts that they vote into law seems to me more an indictment of the laziness of legislators than the any malfeasance or nonfeasance by the executive branch.
Get your reading glasses on, Congress. Okay.
You know, you took an oath to pass laws and to do your duty as legislators. At the very least, read the darn thing, or if you don't, be ashamed enough of it not to use it as a criticism point against other branches and other responsible actors.
But you're a legal scholar, Viet Dinh. What about the big picture here? Do you see something headed out of balance, or are you a proponent of the unitary executive, the more aggressive assertion of executive privilege? Do you think it puts our democracy in the right posture, a healthy posture?
Right. Two observations on that. First of all, I do think that the Constitution vests the executive authority in a president, one president, and so I do think the executive the ideal is unitary. But that does not mean that one advocates the in aggressive use of such executive authority. And so they're two separate observations. I do think that David is somewhat correct in the sense that in a time of war, in a time of insecurity, the executives would need more secrecy and more confidentiality so as to prosecute its duty under the Constitution. The framers very clearly vested this authority and prerogative with the executive so that it can act with, quote, secrecy and dispatch, especially in times of insecurity. Now, one note here is that we have seen each and every single one of these interbranch disputes in the past. David brought up Richard Nixon and Watergate. Obviously, the Chairman Burton in the 1990s and the Clinton administration with respect to Filegate and the Free and Labella memos, almost the script by script follows the exact same playbook, but with different parties in power. In the 1990s, Chairman Dingell and Ann Gorsuch with respect to the environmental prosecutions and the like with threats of impeachment, an actual impeachment note going to the floor of the House. And so we've seen all this before, and never is it a crisis. I do think there is one note here that just as the executive has been aggressive in enforcing state secrets, so too have the public interest groups and the political opponents been very aggressive in both the politics and using the courts in pressing more aggressive claims of openness. I can remember just within the last decade when the NSA used to stand for no such agency, and Fort Meade was not even listed off the GW Parkway on the way to Baltimore. Now, of course, not only do we know what the NSA is, but there are lawsuits and claims about the inner workings and operations of our most sensitive signal intelligence capability.
If we could hold that there for just a second, Ted Gupp, what about it? We've seen all this before. This is not a crisis.
I've not seen this before. Now, I'm only 56, but I will say that Viet Dinh cites a number of very interesting examples. They're instances, and I agree that they represent the same sort of tendency. What's different is that what we're looking at today is not an isolated incident, but a choreographed and comprehensive change of approach and view of the presidency. Yes, previous presidents have invoked the doctrine in individual cases, but in my recollection and in my reporting, I've never seen it so systemic and so broad. I do think Viet Dinh makes an excellent point about the legislators. He is right. They did pass this legislation, Patriot Act and others, but I think he gives a little short shrift to the idea that they don't read. Indeed, they do not. Only 96 members of the Senate read the National Intelligence Estimate on Weapons of Mass Destruction in the debate on going to war with Iraq.
96 out of 100 is not bad. Is that what you mean? 96
did
read it?
Not read.
Did not, excuse me.
Did not read.
Mm-hmm.
Only 4 read it. And there were similarly disturbing numbers about the Patriot Act. I think that he's right that they got the concurrence of the legislative branch, but perhaps the better word would be that they were complicit in the passing of these and to a large degree derelict in failing to do their homework. They have an obligation to read this material, digest it, and vote from an informed perspective.
David Barron, excuse me, does Congress have a right to expect some limit to what the administration would assert in any legislation that it proposes, or is that just too much to expect?
Well, I think it's, you know, whether the legislature has the right to expect it or, you know, the people who elect the president. I mean, we don't elect a president and have the sense that what they will do is press powers that are plausible or there's a fig leaf in which you can make the claim all the way to the limit. And really what's striking is the reference to Roosevelt, and even if you think back to Lincoln, neither of them, faced in times of war and with very serious crises before them and legislation against them that they did not like, took the view that they could simply assert a right to disregard the statutes and then not tell people about it. And that's really, I think, the striking difference here.
We're talking about secrets and executive privilege this hour as Congress and the White House gird for another round of hearings in Washington with Congress back in session. Democratic Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee of Texas railed last month against a bill to allow more warrantless wiretapping, eventually passed with Democrats participating in early August, though Lee voted against it. Here she is.
We are shredding the Constitution. We are tearing up the Bill of Rights because we are telling Americans that no matter what your business is, you are subject to the unscrupulous, undisciplined, irresponsible scrutiny of the Attorney General and others without a court intervention.
Congresswoman Sheila Jackson Lee, Democrat of Texas. Dan is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and David Ted Viet. Excellent conversation today. Let me just start off by saying, yes, I think it's gone way too far. The executive privilege has been asserted to extreme levels. Our founding fathers warned us. The Constitution is the instrument. Eisenhower warned us, beware of the military-industrial complex. Kennedy tried to warn us. He pointed out how the Soviet Unions did the same thing that we're talking about to their people, and the unraveling of our rights very, very gradually and slowly. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's why we have the conspiracy theorist Roswell incident, the JFK and the Warren Commission conspiracies. Now there's a 9/11 truth and the conspiracy about 9/11. Keeping secrets from the Americans is a sacrosanct privilege, and it should not be taken lightly.
Dan, do you expect the pendulum to swing back toward openness, or do you have a concern that we may be in for a kind of perpetual heightened executive privilege?
I think if we allow the executive to continue to control our foreign policy in the way that it has, that we will continue to have the same type of abuse, because it always surrounds military and foreign policy where our national security is at risk, that we always claim that that's why we have to keep it secret from you.
Dan, thank you very much for that. Let's get a call as well from Augusta, Georgia. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I agree with the last caller, and basically my comment is regarding the fact that this administration is always, from the beginning, been very secretive. If you remember the whole debate about who Bush would pick as a running mate, and it wound up being the guy that he selected to lead that effort.
That's his right, though, to choose his running mate, right? He can be as secretive, I guess, as he wants about something like that.
Yes, sir, he does. I'm not discounting that at all. What I'm saying is that trend has continued well into the 6 years or 7 years of his presidency, and some of the secrets they've kept from us were very important to decision-making that were going on. And I think that what this has amounted to is the president has just kind of usurped some power that perhaps he didn't really have the authority to take.
Michael, thanks very much for that from Augusta. And let's go to Davenport, Iowa, get a call there from Gary. Hi, Gary. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. It just occurs to me that if Richard Nixon had asserted such broad executive privilege, we would not have heard the testimony of Ehrlichman, Haldeman, John Dean, Butterfield, nor the White House tapes that we would have had ensconced in the office of the presidency a criminal involved in the obstruction of justice. And I just find it frightening that Bush and this unitary executive theory will go so far as to allow a president to be above the law. In Nixon versus the United States, the Supreme Court said he is not above the law, and we need a Congress that will hold him to account and, if necessary, take him to court. And we need a court that will hold him to account, because the president is not, although a unitary person, he is not the king, he is not the dictator, and he needs to be reined in now.
Gary, thanks very much for that. Viet Dinh, let me go to you. There's three in a row. You hear the kind of allergy from our callers to the secrecy on display here. Do you think these Americans have got it wrong? Are there sort of fundamental assumptions about what's okay and what's not off base somehow?
No, they are not wrong, and they follow a very healthy tradition of American politics, and I think Ronald Reagan put it best in a different context, trust but verify. You know, we come from a nation who is fairly skeptical of government, governmental authority, and especially governmental secrecy, and I think that is a healthy skepticism. However, at times, and out of necessity, our laws and constitution permit the use of confidentiality and secrecy in order to preserve a higher value, that is, of our security and survival. That does not mean, however, that the executive has carte blanche to do what it wants under the cover of darkness. I think there are mechanisms in place for the executive, especially intelligence agencies, to brief Congress through secure channels, through the House Intelligence Committees and Senate Intelligence Committees, in a way that keeps Congress involved in the loop, while at the same time making sure that we have the secrecy and confidentiality necessary to combat our enemies and protect our friends.
Let me ask you, taking that premise for a minute, why then is Congress so angry? Why hasn't this administration fully done exactly what you're describing there?
You know, there were some confusion and conversations when the TSP program was made public, whether or not there was a complete
briefing of HPC and CISI, these two intelligence committees, but my understanding is that they were briefed. If they were not fully briefed or better briefed, I think that we should expect better response from the executive branch. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, Congress are made up of politicians, and politicians will make speeches. At the end of the day, you will notice that despite all of the hue and cry, the USA Patriot Act, after 5 years of operation, was unanimously reaffirmed and extended. And likewise, the despite all the opposition and the great speeches, the surveillance activities of the NSA were authorized by legislation by Congress.
So you have no concern about what's been called here an overzealous, over-aggressive assertion of executive privilege?
I always have that concern, Tom, as we all should as responsible Democratic citizens. But I do not see every single instance as be one of to be worthy of reproach. At the same time, you have to note that every single document relating to U.S. attorney firings from the Department of Justice have been turned over to Congress. That is almost unprecedented in our history, and it makes me quite shudder regarding whether or not the Department of Justice and its prosecutorial conduct is considered to be the core executive privilege anymore. Mm-hmm. Previous to this, I thought it was.
Ted Gupp, Viet Dinh, architect of the Patriot Act, says essentially kind of let settle down. This is within reason in a difficult time.
Well, he also once again cites Congress and says Congress has gone along. I would suggest that Congress has been unduly cowed and deferential to the administration and indeed both parties. When he talks about the intelligence briefings to Congress, I'd like to point out that the GAO, which is the investigative arm of Congress, has been told by the administration that they lack all authority to investigate intelligence matters. So how is it that the Congress can effectively perform oversight and hearings if their investigative arm can't even get out of the stable door to conduct investigations because they're told they're lacking authority? One other point I would point out is that those in Congress that are not cowed, who may want to press the point with regard to subpoenas, et cetera, are very fearful, I believe, and I'd like to hear from David Barron on this, but are very fearful about pressing the matter in the courts because of the changed composition of the courts and some new justices on the Supreme Court who are quite sympathetic to the unitary executive.
David?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, it's a bit of a crapshoot what would happen in the court right now.
Even now, with the president's justices on the court and the changed
court. Well, he's got some, but he doesn't have all of them.
Of course.
And so I think essentially the way I would read it is it's as often happens now with the Supreme Court, it would really be Justice Kennedy who would most likely be the deciding vote. And Justice Kennedy, when you read him, has said two things. On the one hand, in an earlier decision some years ago, he took a relatively strong view of executive prerogatives in the context of getting information about confirmation hearings. But in the other context, which is the war on terrorism, he's been a pretty stout defender of the principle Justice O'Connor laid out, which the president does not get a blank check in wartime, and he's enforced restrictions against the president. So I think you can't really know what his attitude would be if a clean case of executive privilege were to come up.
But that means that the president would have the court but one, in your view? There's only one vote on the Supreme Court likely to push back against this assertion?
No. I'm saying that he would be the deciding vote. So we have 4-4-1.
What that means,
Kennedy
the beat president
it, but
has
got
four votes that you would assume would go along with
that, you know, Justice Scalia, Roberts, and Alito, in their prior history, have all been strong defenders of presidential prerogative. I think they're very much in the tradition you were laying out or someone on the show was laying out earlier of a concern that in the 70s Congress went too far and it's time to restore a much stronger president. After all, Justice Scalia was the head of the Office of Legal Counsel in a prior administration, I believe the Reagan administration, and knows that history well, or maybe it was the Ford administration. In any event, I think there definitely are four who would be sympathetic going in to the president's claims, but that sort of doesn't matter because you need five to win, and both parties
notable that to go in with four votes at a time when some are saying there's a constitutional crisis here, well, that's four justices who would say no.
That's true. I think there are also four, it should be said, who would say yes. In other words, I think there are four who would want to review it pretty carefully, and
no slam dunk here then on either side. Let's take a call from Kathy in Milton, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on the air.
Yes, oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I just want to add my comment that I really think this is all drama and the crisis is all manufactured. Basically, it seems to be over and over the same two political parties trying to tear each other apart. And, you know, I'm an independent, but if I were in Bush's position and with the security issues, I would feel that I had no other alternative but to pull back and to do a lot of the things that he is needing to do. It doesn't appear that to either of the parties' real interest is the country or the people. The fact that only four people have read the bill is just astonishing. That's just basically my comment. It's political drama.
All drama, no real crisis here. David Barron?
I think this is a very important comment because I think there is a sense one could have that what we are seeing is kind of kabuki theater on both sides. It's just politics. Every party makes their argument the way they want to make it.
But the secrecy is not kabuki. They actually are.
No, I say
this is information held in secret.
Totally right. What I'm saying is that does anybody in the branches actually really have a larger interest in play? And the concern the caller's raising is I look at it and I see it's just game playing. They're trying to get partisan advantage. They don't really care about the fundamentals here. And here's the answer I would suggest on that point. Whatever you think of the particular drama playing out, what's undeniable is that in the context of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act program by the president, we've had testimony that upwards of 30 members of the Bush Justice Department were on the verge of resigning because they thought the way it was being carried out was unlawful. That we would never have
Gonzalez
known.
Gonzalez himself at the bedside of John Ashcroft putting the arm on.
We would never have known that, but for testimony before the Senate by the former associate attorney general of the United States, Ted Comey, and the consequence, I think, of that testimony should be that whatever you think of the two parties right now and how they're behaving, there is a quite serious set of questions concerning the rule of law, evidenced not only by that, but by the U.S. attorneys themselves from the Bush administration who have spoken out strongly about their concerns about partisan influence, by various other administrative officials who have talked about political influence. And those are not questions coming out of partisan advantage. Those are coming out of a sense of people doing their job in the bureaucracy, concerned about the direction things are going in. And I think it's incumbent, therefore, that this dispute not be viewed just as a partisan political fight, but as something deeper than that.
Viet Dinh, there it is, 30 justice officials nearly ready to resign. Does that give you pause?
It always should give everyone pause when people like John Ashcroft, Larry Thompson, Bob Mueller, and Pat Philbin, men of great, great stature and integrity, think that something is significant enough that they should consider resigning. I should only note that the full story has not come out and it will not come out because these are folks who do not air their grievances in public, and it may be more complicated, but it does give one a pause, and it also shows a different lesson from my perspective that whatever your political affiliation, however strong your rhetoric, and whatever your skepticism, there are mechanisms in place within our government. There are people of integrity and ability who are there who share your sensibilities and are there in order to protect our liberties. And
but by a thread with Ashcroft in the hospital bed, Ted Gupp, what's your perspective here?
Well, I just want to point out one thing related to this, and that is I do not view this as kabuki or political theater. The defining element or component in all of this debate is the public. Where is the public on this? Are they concerned? And post 9/11, the singular mandate was keep us safe. I think that by and large, the public does not follow this information, does not follow even what is available, much less what's denied them. Two-thirds of the country today does not subscribe to a daily newspaper. I teach courses. I've been teaching classes for years and years, and I can tell you, from my experience at least, that citizens are not keeping abreast of these issues, and if they were, I think this debate would have a greater legitimacy instead of having the potential of being inside baseball. I only wish that citizens took a greater interest. I don't care where they come out on it, but I wish that they would be, just like their representatives in Congress, better informed and more involved.
Ted, do you fear that if these presidents are set that we wake up in a different country, or are we there already?
Well, I think we are in a different country. What I fear, perhaps as much as anything, is a second terrorist attack, which I think would be interpreted by some as evidence of too much laxity in information access and could justify bootstrapping truly draconian measures. I think we're too far along already, but I do fear a second terrorist attack for obvious reasons and for that secondary reason.
Well, watch the hearings coming up. We'll hear what we hear there, see where the ball finally lands here, the combination of Constitution and politics at play. Ted Gutman, Case Western Reserve University, author of Nation of Secrets. Ted, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Viet Dinh, former Assistant Attorney General and legal architect of the USA Patriot Act, professor at Georgetown University Law Center. Viet Dinh, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
David Barron of Harvard Law School with me in the studio. Always great to have you. David, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.